Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Wine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests on Blog Talk Radio as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no whining world of January Jones.
Now let me ask you a question. Can you imagine growing up in Hollywood? Doesn't that sound like fun? Or can you imagine your dad running Columbia Pictures under Harry Cohn? Have you ever wanted to hear about producing or directing a movie? Have you ever wanted to hear the inside story? Tell me, can you imagine having Frank Sinatra as your godfather? Wouldn't that be great? Tell me, do you know what it takes to survive in Hollywood? Yeah. And when was the last time you watched the classic movie Somewhere in Time? It's everyone's favorite. Or better yet, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that we're looking for today? Would you like to learn about old Hollywood? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today I will be introducing my guest. He is a Hollywood from the legendary Hollywood family, and he will provide us with wonderful, informative, and inspirational lessons about his life in Hollywood, and some really, really great advice and some of the inside stories. I'm pleased to announce today that our show is featured on the front page at Blog Talk Radio as a staff pick. I am honored to be a featured host, and we now have over 1 million wonderful listeners. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. And thank you to all of you who went out there to view me. Now, let me tell you about my guest today. He was born into a successful Hollywood family. His father, S. Sylvan Simon, was a producer-director who made films with such stars as Abbott Costello, Lana Turner, and Red Skelton. He worked as both a producer and an executive at Columbia Pictures under the legendary Harry Cohn, producing such films as Born Yesterday, the 1950 film that garnered a Best Actress Oscar for Julie Holliday. Sylvan Simon died when my guest was 4 years old, an event which compelled Frank Sinatra to become his godfather. His mother remarried Armin Deutsch, a film producer at MGM who produced films with such stars as Robert Taylor, James Stewart, and Grace Kelly. In more than 35 years as a producer, director, and production executive, my guest has been involved in the production of over 20 films. I am pleased and honored to welcome to the show today Stephen Simon. Hi, Stephen. How are you doing?
I am doing great, but I have to tell you, I'm still laughing from the introduction to the show. And I completely made a mistake. I thought you were the exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. I'm so surprised that you're not.
Well, you know what? My husband wishes I were.
I have to tell you, that is a great introduction, and I can't even begin to tell you how much I love the No Wine Zone. I just think that's great. So it's wonderful to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, and I can tell that you're not a whiner. You know, one of the themes of my show is success stories, and we like to have our guests share the failures so that people can understand that there's a lot that goes into getting to be successful. Some things are not that terrific. Your chapter one in your book, The Old Hollywood, Nothing Succeeds Like Failure. That's a great title. What prompted you to write that?
Well, I think it's true. I think it's true very much when you're involved in creative endeavors. If you're pushing the envelope and you're involved in the arts in any way, it's really kind of hard to imagine once you've lived a certain amount of life that you haven't crashed and burned more than once,
yeah.
That you haven't failed more than once, that you haven't gone through at least a few dark nights of the soul. It's if you're not doing that, if that hasn't happened, then you're probably not pushing things. You're probably staying in a very safe place. And I happen to be one of those people that does not shy away from the concept of failing. And I have failed in my life. I've done things that have crashed and burned. I've been through a bankruptcy. I've been through all kinds of really difficult things. You know, I've been fired 3 times from movie positions and things like that. And I think that those are things that teach you lessons that are invaluable later in life. And I think it's very important to embrace those failures and not... I know there are some people that say, well, nothing is really a failure because if you learn from it, it's a success. Well, that's true in retrospect.
Yes.
You know, that is absolutely true in retrospect, but it doesn't help when you have actually crashed and burned, when you've done things like I've done, which is make movies that you love that no one went to go see, or get fired from a job, or lose everything and have to start over again. Yeah, those are all great things in retrospect. When you're going through them, they're failures. They hurt like hell.
Mm-hmm.
And you do learn from them, and hopefully you don't repeat them, and then they ultimately do make you a stronger person and get you prepared for the next time.
Sure. And the thing about your life in Hollywood, your failures, they're so public. That's difficult. A lot of us, we have our little failures in life, and it's no big deal. But when you're in Hollywood, oh, my gosh, it's just right out there. Everyone knows about it. They talk about it, and it affects your life in many ways. That's a hard part of the Hollywood scene, isn't it?
Yeah, it very is. That's a very astute observation, and it's very true that those are very public failures. And you really do suffer for them because, as they say in Hollywood, you're only as good as your next film or as your last film. And I remember very vividly Michael Douglas told me a wonderful story right before I started producing my first film, Somewhere in Time, which was in the late 70s, and I was just about to produce it, and I saw Michael, who I had known. I'm not going to say Michael and I were friends, but we were acquaintances. Our parents were very close friends, and he knew I was about to start my film. I just ran into him on the Universal lot, and he said, listen, I got to tell you a story. It's a very important thing for you to understand as a producer. And I said, what? Well, you know, Michael produced One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And they were nominated for a ton of Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Actor. I mean, they had a whole bunch of Academy Award nominations. And Michael said, so I figured that we'd win at least one of those awards. So I set up a whole series of meetings for myself for the day after the Academy Awards to pitch what I hoped would be my next film, because I figured, well, we're going to win one of these things, and I'll have a leg up. Well, sure enough, they won everything. They won every award they were nominated for, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting. Michael won an Oscar for Best Pictures. I think they won 5 Oscars, something like that, 5 or 6. And the next day, Michael said to me, so the next day I went to four or five studios, pitched the project, and they all said no. And he said, so here's what you need to know. It isn't as you're as good as your last movie. You're as good as your next movie.
Oh, my God.
And every single time you start over. And I think in Hollywood, that's very true. I mean, I kind of also compare it to if you're building an automobile, mm-hmm. you put a lot of money into building the assembly line and doing the design and stuff like that. But once you start making the cars,
yeah.
then it's kind of like a cookie-cutter thing. Then you just keep making the cars. Well, mm-hmm. when you make a film, it's mm-hmm. like starting a new auto factory with a whole new line and a whole different design every single time.
Oh, wow.
And when you crash and burn, yeah. and I have done that, you know, it's very painful, and it's very, particularly if your heart is yeah. in the film. You know, if you're making exploitation movies that mm-hmm. are just out there to exploit certain emotions in people, and, you know, you're in it entirely for the money mm-hmm. because you think you can make a buck from this, it's a different thing. But when yeah. you put your heart and soul into something, when you really believe in it, mm-hmm. it's devastating. I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit, but Somewhere in Time, which has now turned out to be
yes.
quite a little cult classic with a big following, things like that. When Somewhere in Time came out and bombed in
really?
1980, and I mean it bombed,
it
just broke my heart.
Oh, I bet it
oh,
broke
yeah,
you.
It was it came and went in 3 weeks, and, you know, it was a critical and box office disaster.
Uh-huh.
When it first came out, and then it took years, and there's a whole story behind that. But, you know, when you put your heart and soul into something, it's very mm-hmm. difficult when it doesn't work.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you talk about Somewhere in Time, I was raised in Michigan, and we used to vacation at Mackinac Island.
And oh, did
that,
you?
Yes, and that movie, of course, everyone in Michigan was just wild about it because it was such a fantastic portrayal of the island. What a great love story. How did that story come to you? How did it come about becoming a movie? It's everyone's
favorite now.
Well,
you know, that's actually what compelled me into the movie business. As you said, I grew up in the business, and my dad was a producer and a director, sure. and mm-hmm. I grew up around a lot of that, but I kind of stayed away from it for a long time. I had worked in politics. I went to law school. I was a lawyer for a very short period of time. Please don't hold that against me. You know, I got out of it very quickly. I'm an ex-lawyer. I don't have to go to meetings anymore. You know, I've gotten over that. But when I was 30 in 1976, I was in a bookstore, and an old bookstore in Beverly Hills called Martindale's. And I saw this book that was recommended to me by one of the clerks called Bid Time Return, and by a wonderful author named Richard Matheson, who I was very familiar with because he'd written some other great books. He was also the guy that had written about a third of the original Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh.
And I was a big admirer of his, and I read this book, and it just transfixed me because I thought, this is one of the greatest love stories
mm-hmm.
I've ever read. And that's when I went to Ray Stark. Ray was one of the great producers, actually, in all in the history of Hollywood. Ray discovered Barbara Streisand. He did Funny Girl on Broadway. He did Funny Girl with her in The Way We Were and a lot of other things. And he did Annie and an enormous number of films. And I knew Ray because my dad was Ray's protege.
Okay.
And so I knew Ray very well, and I went to him and I begged him for a job
uh-huh.
and as his assistant. And I talk about that a bit in the book, but actually I talk about that quite a bit in Bringing Back the Old Hollywood. But to cut to the chase, he did finally hire me. And the reason I did it is because I wanted to make this story, Bid Time Return, this book, into a film. That's what really motivated me to finally get into the film industry, which I knew that I would. So Ray hired me as his assistant. My very first day on the job, I found out who Richard Matheson's agent was, got in touch with him, set up a meeting with Richard, and told him that somehow or another I had just started. This was literally my first week in the film business, but I was going to find a way to make his movie. And 3 years later, Bid Time Return became Somewhere in Time. And the film got made for all kinds of interesting reasons, which is a whole story in and of itself. But then Richard also wrote the novel upon which What Dreams May Come was based. And that became, you know, a film that I did 20 years later. So Richard is one of my idols. He is my mentor. He is one of the people that I love the most in life. And it was because he wrote this book that I got into the film industry.
Well, that's a fabulous film, and now we all love it. You know, Stephen, we're going to take a break and hear about your host. And when we come back with Stephen Simon, I want you to share with us your growing up in Hollywood and having Frank Sinatra as your godfather. We'll be right back. Well, guess what, Stephen? The switchboard is not working, and the commercials are not being played. So we're going to go commercial-free. Doesn't that sound like fun?
Oh, okay, there we go.
There you go. Well, I just had a new computer put in, and I guess this is not a good story. Anyway, we'll skip the commercial. It's more fun talking to Stephen. Tell us what it was like growing up in Hollywood.
Well, I joke around a lot that I think maybe kids get older in Hollywood, but I'm not sure you actually grow up. You know, because it's such an odd, unnatural, weird, artificial atmosphere to grow up in around all of that glitz and all of that money. And it creates a lot of unrealistic expectations. And particularly if you're growing up, and a lot of people I knew growing up in Beverly Hills, which is where we lived, couldn't handle it. And a lot of them later on, sadly, either disappeared into alcohol or to drugs or, and in some cases, even suicide.
Oh, yeah.
Because of their inability to deal with the fact of having famous, well-known parents. And I grew up around that atmosphere, and it was an extraordinary thing for me. You know, you've interviewed my sister, Susan Granger, who is...
I love her.
me too. The hero of my life, my young life. You know, I have two women as heroes, my sister and now my wife. And my sister for the early part of my life was by far and away the most important person in my life. And because I had Susie, who is a little bit older than I am, she likes me to refer to her now as her as my kid sister, but she's a little bit older than I am. Because I had a little bit of an older sister, it really helped me through a lot. And I think what you kind of want me to jump to here, which I will, is the relationship with Sinatra, because you mentioned early on that my dad and Sinatra had a relationship. And it's because my father developed From Here to Eternity.
Okay, well,
Susie actually remembers James Jones, who wrote the book, being around our house when they were working on the script. Dad was going to produce that film, and he was supervising the development of it. And he had always been a big Frank Sinatra fan. He didn't know Sinatra, and there was a part in the book for Frank that Dad thought was going to be great for him, brought Sinatra in, gave him the book, said, this is going to be a great part for you. At that point in his life, Sinatra was kind of down on his luck. A lot of people don't know that. This in the late 40s. He'd made some very bad movie decisions. He had hemorrhaged his voice. You know, he was not in the same place in his career that he had been a few years before or that he would be for the next 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said he wanted to do the film.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was thrilled with the idea of him doing the film. And then everything kind of stopped. My dad then had a heart attack and died.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And it was very quick. In May of 1951, it was right before my fifth birthday.
Wow.
And I didn't really know any of this history, except for the fact as I was growing up, I was very aware that I had this Uncle Frank, who was always giving me these great gifts on my birthday, on Christmas, uh-huh. and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And when I was 18, I was summoned to his house, to Frank's house,
uh-huh.
and he was standing out in front, perched on the hood of a brand-new Corvette 1964 convertible Stingray.
Oh, my God.
And he flipped me the keys and said, "Happy birthday, kid. We're going to talk." That was my 18th birthday present.
Oh, my.
And he took me inside, and he explained to me that Dad had been responsible for him getting the part in From Here to Eternity.
Oh.
And that without that, he never, you know, he said he completely resurrected my career. He stood up for me, which I didn't really quite understand at the time, but I did later. He said he stood up for me, and then he died. He said he died before we even got into pre-production, and I could never repay his generosity, and the only way I've been able to do that is through you. Now, this is kind of the measure of who Frank Sinatra was as a man. This is now almost 15 years since my father's death. And Frank was still feeling that he wanted to do something to, quote, repay the debt. There was no debt, but to repay the kindness. And we hung out together. He took me with him to Vegas at times. I spent an extraordinary amount of time. There was about a 5 or 6 year period there where I spent a lot of time with Frank in the 60s in Vegas and around. And he also said to me, if you ever get in trouble, you need to be, I need to be the one you call. And he gave me a little card that had a private phone number on it, and he told me his secretary, Dorothy, would update that number, which they did. I did eventually get into trouble. We're not going to get into that story in any detail here. People can read the book about that. But, and he got me out of it. And it was just an extraordinary time. Now, fade out. Right around 1968, 69, I'm in Palm Springs visiting Sinatra, and I see Red Skelton in a movie theater.
Okay.
Now, my dad, my birth dad, Sylvan Simon, had and Red had been best friends and collaborators. Dad made several movies with Red Skelton, and I knew that Red had been my dad's best friend. I hadn't seen him since I was a little boy, and I was now 21 or 22, and he was still with his wife, Georgia, at the time. I walked up to him, and I said, "You know, excuse me, Mr. Skelton, you're not going to remember me." And he looked at me, he got big tears in his eyes. He said, "Oh, my God, you must be Sylvan's boy."
Oh, my gosh.
Because I looked so much like my dad, he completely recognized me. We went off, went to a coffee shop, sat down, and started talking. And he asked me about my relationship, you know, what I was there. And I talked about Sinatra. And he said, "Well, do you know this whole story?" And I said, "Actually, I don't." "What story?"
Tell me.
Well, anyone who has seen The Godfather will find this story a little bit reminiscent. So evidently, and Frank, I mean, Red explained this to me. Frank never talked about this with me, by the way, in any detail, ever. Red told me, and then Ray Stark confirmed it, and my mother, to a certain extent, confirmed it, although she was very nervous about doing it. But when my dad had offered Sinatra the job, Harry Cohn, who was the head of Columbia Pictures, vetoed it.
Oh, God.
And it was because of a personal issue that he had with Sinatra. And my dad said, "You can't do that to me. If you do that, I have no credibility. I'm going to resign." Harry Cohn said, "Fine, resign." And my dad did, called Sinatra, told him, then no, a horse's head did not wind up in a bed. But evidently, Harry Cohn owned a great racehorse who was poisoned in its stall.
Oh, dear.
And a note was put under Harry's door saying, "You're next."
Oh, my
now,
God.
Now, I have no, you know, listen, I don't have any belief at all that Frank was involved in any of that. I don't believe that. You know, I know there's all kinds of stories about that. That I don't believe that at all. I think my own belief about this is that, and I was never going to talk to Frank about that, but my own belief is that he found out about that later as well. But Dad was urgently called back to the studio, and, you know, very quickly after that, completely unrelated, he died. And that is how the whole Sinatra, From Here to Eternity, Sylvan Simon, and my relationship with Sinatra came about. And he was extraordinary to me for a long, long time. And, you know, is somebody that I'll always venerate, love, respect. He was just an incredible man.
Wow, what a story, and what an experience to have an association with someone like him. You know, and his story is exactly what we try to stress. He had these situations where he was down, his career was, you know, gone, he was struggling, and then look where he came back and how his success story unfolded. So, I mean, everyone at every level in your industry or every aspect of life goes through failure in order to succeed. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a fantastic story. You know, Stephen, right now we're going to go to my backup switchboard and see if we actually will get a commercial in here. And when we come back, I want you to share your website information and share with my listeners how they can get your books.
Lately, there's a whining epidemic in our world. People are even whining about whining. Are you sick and tired of listening to everyone whining all the time? So was January Jones, the author of Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reached number one at Amazon.com. Ms. Jones based her book on a survey of the top 10 things that people whine about at all ages and all stages of life. January is a success coach that can tell you how to help others. When you buy Thou Shalt Not Whine, the 11th commandment, you'll find out what people whine about and how to stop them from whining. This is the perfect gift book to give or get for any occasion. Thou Shall Not Whine was voted the best gift to be given anonymously for those special people in your life. Ms. Jones is an internationally known author in the style of Irma Bombeck, specializing in housewife humor with her book being published in Korea and China. You can find Thou Shall Not Whine at Amazon.com.
Welcome back with Stephen Simon, and he is also the author of Bringing Back the Old Hollywood. Stephen, could you share your website information and tell my listeners where they can get your books?
Sure. Bringing Back the Old Hollywood is available on Amazon, both in print form and in electronic form. That is the only place that is actually available.
Okay.
There are actually two websites. One is theoldhollywood.com. Mm-hmm. Where you can find out more about the whole aspect of bringing back the old Hollywood. And I also, I must say that the thing that is probably nearest and dearest to my heart that I want to recommend to people is spiritualcinemacircle.com.
Okay.
Spiritualcinemacircle.com. This is a talk about a labor of love. It's not even a labor. This is a company that my partners, Gay and Katie Hendricks, and I started. We're in our 10th year now. We have subscribers in all 50 states and 80 foreign countries. People, our subscribers, get four movies a month, which they own, that we distribute to them. And these are all movies that are designed to make you feel better about being human. They're all very uplifting, transformative, powerful, comedic, dramatic, documentaries. We've distributed now over 450 films, and I said we're going into our 10th year, and the first month is always free. So I recommend that people go to spiritualcinemacircle.com. I think it's something that you'll get a lot of enjoyment out of and feel better about being human, which is not an easy thing to get from most media today.
Yeah. Does it work like Netflix where you just select a movie and it's sent to you, or how does it?
No, the way Spiritual Cinema Circle is a very different model. We select the movies. We send out three shorts and a feature to our subscribers every month. And unlike Netflix or things like that, you don't return these movies. These are movies that you get to own. And subscribers who have been with us now for since we started have bookshelf, or now bookshelves probably, with 450 films on them. And what I find, and one of the reasons we wanted to do this, is because we wanted our subscribers to have movies on different subjects that if you have friends or family members that are going through challenging times, you can say, hey, there was a movie from the Spiritual Cinema Circle that just deals with that, and a lot of these are shorts. So that, you know, you can sit down and watch them with a friend in 10, 15, 20 minutes, and You know, we have a Facebook page. It's very active. People can look that up as well. And I'm very proud of this business, and I hope people will take a look at it. As I said, the first month is always free. You get a chance to look at what we're doing, and I think people will find it really uplifting and empowering.
Well, it sounds fantastic, and I know that I will be subscribing to it later today, and I hope that everyone who's listening will consider doing it. After all, the first month is free, so if it's not your cup of tea, you don't have to continue.
That's exactly why we did it that way.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, Stephen, let's talk about someone else you worked with and knew in Hollywood as a child and eventually in the political world, Ronald Reagan. Tell us what your story about him. It's fabulous.
Sure. Well, my mom was, and Nancy, originally Nancy Davis and then Nancy Reagan, were very good friends starting in the 40s before she and the president were ever married, and at that point he was the actor Ronald Reagan. And when she married, my family became very close friends, and President Reagan was around a lot. And he came to parties at my in my family's house, and I always found him to be a very unique man when it came to a lot of the people that I met in that circle, because he was so warm and human and down to earth. There were, he had no airs about anything. And, you know, when you're a kid and your parents have dinner parties, most of the adults kind of dismiss you. It's just the way it was, certainly was then. And he was never that way. I just found him wonderful. And I actually, when I was 14, 15, 16, had a horse that I kept at his ranch, his original ranch. And we used to go riding on Saturday mornings together. And this was probably 1960, 61. This is well before he ran for governor, well before he got into politics. And I just loved him as a human being. He was just wonderful. And then when he decided to run for governor, I was in college, my first couple of years in college in the University of Pennsylvania, and I kind of I left to come back to work for him, and it was really not as much of a political statement as it was a human statement. I just loved that man. He was just wonderful. And he got elected, and I went back to school, and, you know, then obviously he became president, and, you know, he was just a wonderful person, and he and Nancy were always very thoughtful, and I actually just had a communication. I wrote Nancy a letter about a month or so ago, and she sent me a really sweet response back, and, you know, it was just, he is one of the most wonderful people, and I'm going to not get into a political discussion here. Sure. As a human being, Ronald Reagan was just an extraordinary man.
Well, you know, I always think about him, and, you know, if I were casting a movie and wanted to cast someone as president, he would be my first choice.
Yes, absolutely.
And one of the things I've enjoyed so much in life is taking my grandchildren. I haven't taken all seven of them, but I've gotten four of them to the Ronald Reagan Library.
Yeah, that's quite a experience.
Oh, yeah, that in Simi, California. And that, whether you're, no matter what your political views are, that library is so well done, and it inspires such a feeling of love of country and service. You know, I highly recommend everyone going there. That's a great story that you got to know him. Tell us about some of the other stars that used to come to your home, and what were your impressions of them?
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that is a long list of people. Well, I'll tell you the ones that come to my head the most. Rosalind Russell comes to my head because she was just such a hoot. She was kind of exactly what you thought she might be. The woman who played Auntie Mame was a lot of that in life. She was just a she was so wonderful and outgoing and fun. And Debbie Reynolds was a very, very kind person. I mean, I can only relate to, you know, how people related to me. John Cassavetes, on the other side of the spectrum, was somebody who inspired me very much as a filmmaker. John was, I knew him, my stepdad made a movie with him when he was still an actor called Saddle the Wind, him and Robert Taylor. Uh-huh. And he really inspired me and continued to inspire me as I got into the film industry. Mm-hmm. I remember meeting Elizabeth Taylor a couple of times and being, you know, as everyone else, you know, taken aback at what a beautiful woman she was. I really, you know, never spent much time around her. Mm-hmm. Freddie DeCordova, who produced The Tonight Show, was a very close friend of my dad's and my stepdad's, and a great guy. Billy Wilder was my stepfather's best friend. They had lunch together, I think, every week for 30 years, and he was quite a wit as well. And, you know, those are the ones that come to mind right away.
Oh, fantastic. You know, you also, I want to have you share a little bit about the movies that you've worked on with, of course, Christopher Reeve, what a fabulous man, and Robin Williams, Cuba Gooding Jr., and Tom Cruise. Tell us what Christopher Reeve was like when you worked with him.
Well, you know, that was a great story, that whole Christopher Reeve experience. That, you know, we developed this little movie, Summer in Time, which is this very, you know, small, it was kind of designed to be kind of like A Portrait of Jenny, a movie from the 40s, you know, those kind of romantic fantasies. And it was not at a time in which films like that were really in vogue in Hollywood. And I talk about the background in bringing back the old Hollywood to how actually that film got into development, which I'm not going to talk about now, but people can read that if they take a look at the book. But we got to a point with Universal where every project has this moment where it's either going to happen or it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that before I tell you this quick story, when we had that meeting, it was about 3 weeks, I think it was early January of 1980, and the reason that's important is because about 3 weeks earlier, Superman 1 had opened and became this gigantic hit, and Christopher Reeve became the hot guy. You know, everybody wanted Christopher Reeve. And I had thought of several other actors to be in Somewhere in Time, but we got into that meeting with the head of Universal, the meeting. It was a wonderful man named Ned Tannen, the director, Jeannot Swark and I. And he started off the meeting by saying, turning to Jeannot and I and saying, you know, I love you guys. And as soon as you hear that,
you know,
a huge butt is coming. You know, a huge butt. And he said, I love you guys, but, and I said, hey, Ned, what if we get Christopher Reeve? And I thought Jeannot was going to kill me. I thought I was going to kill myself. Because as soon as the words got out of my mouth, I knew what was going to happen. He said, what, are you kidding? He said, you get Christopher Reeve, you can make your movie.
Oh, wow.
He said, but remember, you only have $4 million to make this movie with, which means I don't know how much you have for the actor, but you're going to have to fit Reeve into that. And I said, well, wait a minute. There are some other people. He said, no, there are no other people, Stephen. Get Christopher Reeve. You can make your movie. Don't get Christopher Reeve. You can't.
Oh, wow.
So we leave the meeting, and Jeannot looks at me, you know, like the Laurel and Hardy thing. You know, this is another fine mess you've gotten us into. And what are we going to do? So I called Chris's agent, and I explained it to him, and he actually laughed at me. He said, how much do you have? And I said, $500,000. He said, I'm getting $2 and $3 million offers. Now, remember, this is 30 years ago.
Sure.
You know, $2 and $3 million then for a big actor is like $20 million today. I mean, there's been this gigantic explosion in salaries. And he said, I'm not even going to show this little thing to him. No. So Jeannot said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, we're desperate. So we're driving down Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. And those of you who have been in L.A. know that there are people on various street corners in Bel Air and in Beverly Hills selling star maps. Now, I grew up in that area, and I know that those star maps, a lot of them are just fictional. Because when you say, hey, listen, Bruce Willis lives in that house, unless Bruce is out mowing the lawn, how are you going to know whether Bruce? So, I mean, I knew that growing up, that a lot of those maps are just phony, or they're old, or they're out of date. And I said, okay, look, so we got a star map, and it showed Christopher Reeve at this house in the Hollywood Hills. And I said, Jeannot, we're getting a script, and we're going to go to the house. And he said, I cannot believe we're doing this. I said, hey, look, this is what happens. Desperate people do desperate things. Who knows? So here we go. We drive up to this house. He is like, are you out of your mind? And I said, yes. We knock on the door, and Chris opens the door.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought we were both going to pass out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I finally said, I kind of got it. I stumbled out of my, I'm a producer. This is my director. We have this film, and I told him briefly about it. Uh-huh. And, you know, he was very polite, but he was kind of like, what are you guys doing here? And how do you, and, but I finally said, but your agent won't show it to you.
Oh.
And that, I saw a glint in his eye. He said, what do you mean he won't show it to me? Come in.
Uh-huh.
And we went in, and we told him briefly the story, and he said, okay, give me the script, give me your phone number, I'll read it tonight, I'll call you tomorrow morning. So we both went home very nervous. He called me in the morning. He said, get Jeannot, come to the house. We went to the house, and he said, guys, got two things to tell you. Number one, this is going to be my next movie.
Okay.
Number two,
great.
I just fired my agent.
You're kidding.
Which he did, and I'm not going to mention the agent's name, but the agent never spoke to me again. And Chris said, this is exactly what I want to do after after Superman. It's a complete change of pace.
Right.
This is precisely what I want to do. And he said, so I know you guys don't have a lot of money. He said, just tell me how much is there for the lead actor. Just be frank with me. And I said, $500,000. He said, done. I've got it. You got me. Let's go.
Wow. That's
that started the process. And then, you know, we cast Jane Seymour, and the movie got made. And
Christopher Reeve was such a classically well-trained actor. So I could
see
that he would want to get out of the Superman genre and get into his real forte, which you're
going to Yeah, and he actually told me sometime after that, not in that meeting, but he told me sometime later, that we were also fortunate in that his agent had given him a script that had a $3 million offer attached to him to play a Viking, not the football Vikings in Minnesota, to play an actual Viking. And Chris said, I had this vision of me with one of those inverted gourds on my head. And he said, not a chance. I got to do something completely different.
Oh, good.
You know, we stayed friendly. I'm not going to say we became close friends, but we certainly stayed friendly. He was wonderful throughout the entire shoot. Mm-hmm. And after his tragic accident, and I talk about this in the book as well, there were certain things that went on after that. And I actually then went and had a meeting with him, and we actually were talking about him after his accident directing a film that I was producing for various reasons that never happened. But, you know, I've always said, and I believe this, that accidents, maybe you need to put a quote around accident, because I've always said that and felt that the guy who played Superman on screen after what happened to him with that horse actually became Superman. And, you know, he became such an extraordinary inspiration to everybody and to the whole world. And I was just completely convinced, and so was he, that he was eventually going to get up and walk. And I actually went to see him once, and he did have some movement in his fingers, which he was very, very happy to, you know, to be able to demonstrate. And, you know, after about the third or fourth time, he said, you want to see this again? And I said, no, I'm bored. And he said, I don't care. I'm going to show you again. He had a great sense of humor. And just one last thing about him, talking about his sense of humor, and he tried to make everybody feel so comfortable. Treat Williams, the actor Treat Williams, was a good friend of Chris's. And Chris actually told me this story. That when Treat came in to see him one day, he walked in the room. He said, hey, Chris, don't get up. And Chris cracked up. Yeah. So he was just a great guy.
And the interesting thing is he played a hero on the screen, and then in real life he became a hero for the entire world.
He sure did.
He was the real deal.
He was the real deal. There's just no question. He was an extraordinary, extraordinary, extraordinary man.
Fabulous man. You know, we're going to take a break, and I want to share with my listeners some information about an organization that I support They're wonderful people doing wonderful things. And we'll be right back with Stephen Simon.
What is AATH? The Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor is a nonprofit, member-driven international community of humor and laughter professionals and enthusiasts. AATH provides its members the education, cutting-edge resources, and supportive community they need to excel in the practice and promotion of healthy humor. AATH welcomes anyone who is interested in learning more about the application and benefits of therapeutic humor. Members include scholars, psychologists, counselors, nurses, social workers, physicians, educators, clergy, hospital clowns, and many others who incorporate humor in their life and work. AATH was created to disseminate information about humor and laughter, laughter play, and well-being. Provide a caring, supportive community of humor professionals and enthusiasts. Check out our AATH at www.aath.org today.
And for all the people in the San Diego area, AATH will be having their annual convention April 4th to the 7th, and the convention center there. And if you can, stop by. They're wonderful people, and you will enjoy meeting them, and they will make you laugh. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about one of my very favorite people in Hollywood, Robin Williams. And also, we want to hear about what it was like working with Tom Cruise.
Let me take them in chronological order. When we made All the Right Moves with Tom, we shot it in 82 or 83. I'm beginning to fade. I think it was early 83. And Tom, the director, Michael Chapman, and I had seen Tom in a film called Taps, and we thought he was really wonderful, and we interviewed him. He had committed to being in Risky Business, which is really the film that made Tom a star, but he hadn't started shooting it yet.
Okay.
And we cast him to star in our film. He went off to Chicago to shoot Risky Business and then came to Johnstown to shoot All the Right Moves right after Chicago. Okay. And I laugh about this now. I remember we had such a huge argument with 20th Century Fox at that point because we wanted to give Tom $125,000 to star in the film, and they didn't think he was worth it. And now, that's less than he gets paid probably in a day, of shooting. What's also kind of eerie and wonderful about this is that we shot that movie in Pennsylvania in 1980, the beginning of 1983, and almost 30 years later to the moment, it was actually 29 years later, my nephew, Don Granger, who got into the business, worked with me on Summer in Time as when he was 16 years old, got the movie business bug himself, got in, became a very successful executive at Paramount. Then he ran Tom Cruise's company for many years. And then 30 years after we made All the Right Moves in Pennsylvania, Don went back and just produced Jack Reacher with Tom in Pennsylvania. So it all kind of stayed in the family. The What Dreams May Come story was, again, there's a long chapter in the book about What Dreams May Come. That is a 20-year journey in my life.
Wow.
It took me 20 years to get that film made. There were a lot of, quote, failures, unquote, along the way, some mistakes that I made along the way, some bad decisions that I made along the way. But ultimately, it wound up, we were getting into the process of making the movie, and we offered it to Robin, and I'll never forget the first meeting we had with him, because the director, Vincent Ward, and I, and the writer of the script, Ron Bass, went to visit with Robin. I think it was in San Francisco. Robin walked into the room, and he said, "Guys, not only am I going to be the star of this movie, I want to play all the parts." And he sat down and he said, "So let's talk. I want to play every part in the movie."
Okay.
But that was quite a departure. I mean, that's not a light romantic comedy. That's a very, very dramatic role. And again, there's a much longer story about that in the book, which I won't go into now. But it was an extraordinary experience, and you know, I still get. And What Dreams May Come is considered in Hollywood to be a failure as well, because
oh, really?
If you don't make a lot of money, you're a failure.
Even if you win an Academy Award.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, Hollywood kind of judges things on one scale. And it's something really, Kevin Costner is credited with this, and I hope it was him. I believe it was him that said this. If not, I'm going to give him credit for it. Kevin Costner said, you know, judging a film and what you've done with your film when it comes out is really not the right metric to use. He said, if 5 years later, somebody has a friend over in their house and says, oh, I've got a movie you need to see, and hands them a DVD, then you know you're a success. And it's really standing the test of time. And I must say that What Dreams May Come and Somewhere in Time and All the Right Moves, all of them have become more successful over time than they were when they first came out. And that's been very, very comforting for me. I mean, very, very comforting. And, you know, they've built, you know, particularly Somewhere in Time and What Dreams May Come have built very passionate followings. And, you know, we read things every once in a while that, you know, something like Jennifer Aniston saying that Somewhere in Time is her favorite romantic movie. And, you know, other people with What Dreams May Come. I remember the musician Prince. I heard this, saw Robin at an award show and ran up and hugged Robin and said, you know, that's my favorite movie you've ever made. And when you hear things like that 10, 20, 30 years later, it's very gratifying to know that those films are still saying in certain people's consciousnesses. I'm not a mass market filmmaker. You know, I've never been somebody that has his finger on the pulse of mainstream audiences. It's just not who I am. Never have been, never will be. It's just, you know, I have a particular focus. The audiences for these films are not big in terms of quantifiable numbers, but in terms of passion, people really love the films, and the people who love them really love them, and to me, that's really rewarding.
Well, you know, I'm right with you on that, because every little town has their own little artsy-fartsy theater, and it's the only theater in the town that shows really, really great movies. And I have supported ours in every town I've lived in, because some of these movies, they don't come out with mass distribution and they're gems. Well, like, look at this year, Amour was one of those movies that you had to search. You had to search it out. I had to drive an hour and a half to go see it. And a lot of these movies don't come to the big theaters, and so many people miss them. And I suppose that that would be a good reason for your spiritual cinema circle.
Yes, I was going to say, thank you for that. That is exactly what we do. We curate what we consider. We curate these films because 90% of the films that we distribute to the circle, people are not going to find anyplace else. Or if they are, they do, it's going to be very obscure or difficult to find, and you're not going to really have heard of the film. We distribute shorts that basically don't get much distribution anywhere other than the circle. And the features, a lot of the features we have, which are just wonderful, are films that no one ever found out about, no one ever heard about because they don't have big stars in them, and because they didn't get big, big theatrical. And it doesn't mean that there aren't wonderful, involving, terrific movies that people would love. It's just that they've never heard of them before. And that is one of the things that we're most proud of at Spiritual Cinema Circle, that we find those films. And, you know, also people can, if they want more to look at it, that go to the Spiritual Cinema Circle Facebook page and read the comments of our subscribers to our films and to the service. And you'll see how people really love these and look forward to getting them every month. And I, again, I hope people will try it out, because I think it's something that will make a big difference in your life. And there's some, you know, we've been around now for almost 10 years, and there's a reason for that, and that is the product is something that is really making people feel better about being human beings.
Absolutely. And to all my 1 million listeners out there, I want to tell you that I will be subscribing later today to Spiritual Cinema Circle, and I actually am looking forward to having Stephen back on my show in May, and when he comes back, we're going to talk about the movies that I've seen that have been sent to me from Spiritual Cinema Circle. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah, it will be fun. And, you know, I wanted to mention a lot of movies have subtitles, and sometimes people get turned off by that. And I think you have to, you know, override that and experience it, because some of the movies with subtitles are fantastic. Don't you agree, Stephen?
Yes, and, you know, you put your finger on something else that happens with us from time to time in the Spiritual Cinema Circle. Actually, the movies for March, now, if someone signs up today, they're not going to get the movies for March. Your first Your first volume will be April. In April, I think our feature is called The Last... It is. In April, the feature is The Last Brickmaker in America, starring a very unknown actor that, you know, is brand new in the world and no one's ever heard of, a guy named Sidney Poitier. Yeah, but, you know, one of the great institutions. And again, people say, what, Sidney Poitier was in a movie that I never heard of before? Yes. But the film that we had in March, which is a wonderful film called Chinese Takeaway, which was actually shot in South America. I think it's from Argentina, as I think where it was originally shot, was subtitled. And we do that from time to time. If we find a film that we think is really, really great, if the quality is what we think for the circle, we do that in our subscribe, and we do that with shorts from time to time as well. And all of our films are closed captioned for people, by the way, want them to be, if you have that need in your life, then, you know, all of our films are closed captioned.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I'm so pleased to have shared this hour with you, Stephen.
Is the hour gone?
Yes, it's gone.
Oh, my goodness. Boy, that was certainly fast. Okay.
I know. Well, we've enjoyed having you on the show and sharing your wonderful, bringing back old Hollywood tales and telling us all about the opportunity to enjoy some really quality films in your home that you can share with everyone you love and care about. And I'm looking forward to having you back in May, Stephen.
Thank you so much. It was great, great fun.
You're welcome. To my listeners, we hope you've enjoyed our show today, and be sure to catch all of our interviews and guests with constant streaming at Blog Talk Radio 24/7. My upcoming guests for the rest of this week are all energizing, exciting, eclectic, and they will amaze, amuse, and they will astonish you. This is the show where you hear inspiring information that will help you to become successful too. If you've enjoyed the show today, please click the follow tab under my picture and become a regular listener by registering with Blog Talk. I personally would love to welcome you to our wonderful no whining world. You know, we love sharing our stories and secrets for success. It's our hope that we can encourage all of you out there to emulate our guests today and every day. And remember my mantra, if you think it, then you can do it. And now for my chocolate comment of the day. Let me ask you, why is there no such organization called Chocoholics Anonymous? Well, you want to know why? It's because no one wants to quit. So for now, all of you, please stop whining, start smiling, and start sharing our success show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. Again, thank you to my wonderful guest, Stephen Simon, the author of Bringing Back Old Hollywood. All of his contact information is on our show page, so be sure to go there and check out his website and all the wonderful things he's told us about Spiritual Cinema Circle. This is January Jones, thanking you for joining me today on my journey and reminding you to take care and stay safe.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Story. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.